How long has it been since you last shared a holiday meal around a big table with extended friends and family? It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent, my last Thanksgiving dinner was just my immediate family in the garage with the garage door open. What's it going to be like when we break bread once again with a larger family circle, including those we disagree with? And what do you think are the best ways to keep from becoming disagreeable? Are you going to be at an in-person Thanksgiving this year? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. We thought we'd ask the experts about how to best wade through these holiday meals and the extended family that perhaps we have not seen for more than a year plus. Dr. Karen Tamarius is the founder of Smart Politics, a progressive organization aiming to help people who disagree communicate effectively. Karen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And also joining us this morning, Carolyn Lukensmeyer. She's the founding director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. It's an organization that works to reduce political dysfunction and incivility. Carolyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. Delighted to be here.
Karen, I will start with you and just ask, when I am about ready to approach somebody that I know I disagree with, I have seen them on social media, I am certain where they stand, and I am all equally certain I do not stand with them, but I do have to sit with them at the dinner table. How do I even begin my approach? Karen?
Is that Karen or Carolyn?
Sorry. Let's start with Karen this morning.
Okay, thank you so much. The first thing to do when you're starting a conversation and you're really worried about what they're going to say is to do it in a very non-judgmental and kind of open-ended way. So introduce a topic that you're interested in discussing and broach it with a wide open question that shows that you're curious about hearing their perspective rather than offering your own.
And so, Carolyn, with Thanksgiving and other holidays now approaching, families may be debating between having a gathering at all if some folks might not be vaccinated or others don't feel safe. How do you begin to set hard boundaries with big holidays like these?
Well, Lee, this is a challenge for literally millions of families across the country, making the decision, is everyone going to be invited or are people who are not vaccinated not welcome? So you have to begin with the family having really open discussions prior to the holiday about what the ground rules are. And then once you've made that decision, if in fact you think there's still big differences of opinion about vaccination that may come up at the table, what's most important is for everyone, and it's similar to what Karen said, approach this with the intention of learning why people feel the way they feel about being vaccinated, where they're getting their information, and how they made their decision. Always avoiding starting out with the judgment of you should be vaccinated or you shouldn't be vaccinated.
And Carolyn, I mean, as the founding director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, give us an example or some examples of what you've heard transpiring over the holiday table. Some of the political fights that you've been privy to.
Well, that's a great question, Lee, because actually at the Institute, after the 2016 presidential campaign, we began to get thousands of inquiries about what to do about that Thanksgiving holiday. Mm. The issue that year was, who did you vote for, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? So this issue of very strong boundaries of disagreement and judgment, whether it's about who you voted for, whether it's about you wear a mask, whether it's about the vaccine, this has now been with us for 5 years. And particularly this year, with the gap created because of COVID, families want to be together. And we get a huge number of inquiries about how can we be together that recognizes the importance of our relationships, but also allows us to keep the conversation civil when we profoundly disagree.
That's Carolyn Lukensmeyer, founding director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, also joining us this morning to help us wade through our holiday meal and extended family. Karen Tamarius, the founder of Smart Politics. And Karen, I'll ask you, what are some concrete actions that we can do to have a productive conversation over the holiday dinner table?
There are a number of things, and it actually starts with what you don't do, and often getting rid of the things that the mistakes that we are inclined to make can go a long way toward improving the interaction. So the kind of the three big things I find get in people's way are telling other people what to think, like just coming in and saying, this is how it is. Anybody who knows anything knows that this is the way to see the world. The other thing is making people feel bad about themselves. So implying that if you disagree with me, you are somehow a bad person. And then the other thing, and this one shocks a lot of people, is actually getting into it and arguing with facts and reason, trying to make some kind of case for why you are right and they are wrong. In general, all three of those approaches tend to backfire and send conversations off the track. What we really need to do in a dialogue is focus on building the relationship. And the more you can build the relationship between you and the other person, the easier it will be to talk about the areas that you disagree.
Well, let me ask you this, because sometimes the holiday conversation can move to the inane. We can talk about football ad nauseum or just go on and on about the weather all day. But those seem to, while they may be small talk and may not be the big issues of the day, those may go to the heart of what you're referring to, Karen, and that is building the relationship and doing so on things that may we can all agree on. It's cold outside and the Packers are good.
Yeah, one of the things we lose sight of when we start thinking about political differences in particular is how much we have in common. And if we can remind ourselves of what we like about each other and respect about each other before venturing into those areas of disagreement, that can kind of build a bridge that will support us in those areas of disagreement in the conversation. So what I really emphasize is that going into these conversations, you first build a support of comfort, which is making people feel safe enough to, express themselves authentically, build connection, which means establishing trust. And that means really, I am going to care about you and love you no matter what your views are, and comprehension. So showing them that you really get where they're coming from and that you're trying to see the world through their eyes before expressing your own differences of opinion.
So to recap here, the do's would be broad strokes, build the relationship. The don'ts would be one, don't tell them what to think, don't make them feel bad, and don't argue.
Yeah, you got it.
Sounds good. Carolyn, would I actually be able to change somebody's mind over a holiday dinner table? Can you actually move somebody's opinion?
That's a great question. What you can do is create the safe space that Karen referred to, get people to talk about their personal stories related to the vaccine rather than their opinions. And what they will quickly begin to discover is that they probably have more in common than they have that divides them. So I think changing an opinion, particularly when it's a dug-in position like people are now in the vaccine, is not the target. But the target is discovering that we care more about the relationship and that we have more in common than we thought. And that most interesting on the vaccine question is most people had some ambivalence along the way, whichever decision they made. So creating the space for people to talk about the ways they felt conflicted creates that space of connection. So we both have an immune system vulnerability. I decided to get vaccinated, you decided not to. As we're telling our stories, we find more places to join emotionally in terms of what a tough decision this really is for many, many people.
very much changing my perspective. I go in with thinking about all the news of the day to a holiday meal, which really doesn't need all the news of the day. It just needs those connections with the ones around you who perhaps you have not seen for far too long. And those connections could be as simple as the chilly weather outside or the Green Bay Packers on the field, although they will not be playing for Turkey Day tomorrow. So will you be at a get-together with those who may not be vaccinated? And is that weighing on you this turkey season? Do you think you'll have a contentious Thanksgiving dinner this year? And if not, how do you do it? 1-800-642-1234. A conversation continues with Carolyn Lukensmeyer, founding director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and Karen Tamarius, founder of Smart Politics. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So the don'ts over the holiday meal. Don't tell others what to think. Don't make them feel bad and don't argue with them. Seems pretty simple, broad strokes. But what about another don't? Like, don't just keep quiet through Thanksgiving dinner and concentrate on not rolling your eyes? It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're getting best practices for persevering through the holidays this year. And our guests are here to help us express ourselves and our point of view without having to make an argument. Now, how do you do that? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to join us. Ideas@WPR.org is the email. Karen Tamarius is the founder of Smart Politics. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is the founding director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, here to take your calls until 7:30. And Carolyn, you mentioned before about the work that your organization did after the 2016 election to bring families back together. How do you see this Thanksgiving different from those in years past?
Each year, these divisions have become more personal. Whether or not I get vaccinated has directly an impact on my health and potentially even my life. Whereas in 2016, when we were talking about who we vote for, although people are intensely identified with that decision, it is not a matter of life and death. So I think the intensity and difficulty of respecting each other's decisions have really deepened over this period of time. And Lee, one thing we haven't talked about yet that's really important in this process is learning to ask questions, particularly when you are triggered by something the other person has said, rather than stopping them or trying to give them different information. Ask another question. On the vaccine issue, we've found the question, what do you wish people understood about your decision? Often opens up more space for an authentic conversation. Or what in your decision most reflects deep values that you hold about how you want to live your life? So you can see how that kind of question takes the conversation to a very different level.
And Karen Tamarius from Smart Politics, one of the things that we do have to seem to have in common from going back to the issues over the holiday table and in the after the 2016 election is that we seem to be operating under different data sets, that our opinions are coming from two different points of not view, but two different fact sets. So how do you begin to overcome the fact that we have actually divided up where our facts are between each other?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are some very strong factual differences out there. But one of the things I think people misread about political conversations is there's this belief out there that you need to agree on the facts in order to have a meaningful and productive conversation. And that actually is a myth. You can have a great conversation and still have significant factual differences. And this is kind of one of the things that I think my psychiatry training helps me out with a lot. As a practicing psychiatrist, I often dealt with patients who were delusional. They simply were out of touch with reality, sometimes in very large ways, sometimes in small ways. And it was understood through my training that when you encounter a patient like that, you don't fixate on trying to disabuse them of these facts that are untrue. And instead, you focus on the parts of reality that they are getting right. And that's what you talk about. And so that's exactly what we need to do in political conversations as well. If there's a significant factual dispute, don't focus on that area. Focus on the things that you can agree on and develop that. And often that actually provides a certain incentive. So let's say you're talking with someone who is bought into a conspiracy theory. If you spend all your time trying to convince them the conspiracy theory is false, you're actually kind of rewarding them for engaging in that kind of thinking. And you're developing those neural networks, making them stronger.
But so how would I go about is with somebody with an unfounded conspiracy theory at my holiday table? I'd be interested in knowing how I'd go about finding any common ground with them.
Right. Well, instead, you look to a larger picture. So if, for example, a common conspiracy theory right now is the QAnon conspiracy theory. And if I was at the family dinner and someone was talking about QAnon, I probably would make a statement such as, wow, it sounds like you have a lot of concerns about whether our political representatives are actually representing us or whether they are being controlled by other interests. And so that kind of concern about whether you're really being represented by your government is a very legitimate concern, something that we can all connect with at a factual level. It is reality based. And then you don't have to engage with all of the strangeness and minutiae and delusional content of the QAnon conspiracy.
Dr. Tamarius, I appreciate that. Karen Tamarius from Smart Politics also joining us this morning. Carolyn Lukensmeyer from the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and you as well at 1-800-642-1234. How do you deal with family members who disagree with you? And have you ever had a major dust up during the holidays, and how did you find resolution there? I'd be interested in knowing. 1-800-642-1234. Mike from Spooner called, couldn't stay with us, but he says his family is very liberal. He's conservative. Mike's family tries to engage with him during the dinner table, but he does not engage. He says, typically says something like, well, this is how you want it, and tries to move on. But Mike said it's gotten worse in the last year, and the conversation always seems to be steered back towards politics. Carolyn, so what's Mike to do when the conversation keeps going back to the things that he disagrees with his family on?
Well, Mike's circumstance is repeated in many families all across the country, where the majority of the family is one end of the ideological perspective, and a single or maybe two members are at the other end. And I think Mike's choice to just essentially try not to engage is probably what most people do. I think Mike having the opportunity to ask a question around something again, like, why is it so important to you to convince me to change from what I care about and what I value to what you value? So again, it shifts the level of the conversation off of, is it right or wrong to be conservative or liberal? Or we love each other. We're all members of a family. Why can't I have an opinion, hold an opinion different than yours? So you take the conversation, so to speak, up a level and off the argument of, is conservative or liberal better politics?
Which is not unlike the case in the following the 2016 presidential election, right? There is something bigger than left or right or Democrat or Republican.
Exactly. And in the current situation with vaccines, the question again is, it's a matter of health, not just for myself, but a matter of health for my entire family and for the community. So you take it to the discussion of, what's our responsibility to be able to really live together and to be able to really communicate with one another?
Only have about a minute left here, but Karen, I'll ask you this before we go this morning. When's it not okay to mend a fence?
Yeah, every once in a while that happens. And really the clear line there is when someone is being abusive. If someone repeatedly violates your boundaries, treats you disrespectfully, calls you names despite asking them not to do that, then you have no obligation to continue engaging with them. And as a matter of fact, you have a, you know, it is your priority to protect yourself and your health.
Dr. Karen Tamarius, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. She's the founder of Smart Politics. And Carolyn Lukensmeyer, always a pleasure to speak with you as well. Happy holidays.
Lee, thanks, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Carolyn's the founding director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. Up next, news, then a story from Wisconsin Life about what walks in our walls. After that, we talk tips and tricks for tomorrow's turkey trot races. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and your invitation to tomorrow's turkey trot races is right around the corner. But first, Wisconsin Life. Here's Brad Kohlberg with a story about home renovation and hidden treasure.
You never know what you might find once you start renovating an old home, but that can be half the fun. Author Ron Davis thinks building and renovating are acts of faith, and he shares this story of odd coincidence and wishful thinking.
Anyone who's done serious renovation of an older home, ripping down lath and plaster, wrestling with stubborn 2x4s, and prying up floorboards, has probably harbored the fantasy of finding some kind of long hidden treasure. Civil War medals, a moth-eaten bag of precious coins, possibly a secret diary full of scandalous confessions. Unfortunately, what is often discovered are crumbling foundations, rotted timbers, and plumbing issues, if not a desiccated mouse or two. But sometimes a do-it-yourselfer finds a shoe. Through an amazing coincidence, two of my friends living 200 miles apart in Wisconsin told me shoe discovery stories. One was Celia, who found a dainty little girl's shoe in the recess above a window she and her husband Paul were replacing in their 1890s farmhouse in Amherst. The shoe was worn through, the leather cracked, but the cunning button hooks that ran up the side and its pointed toe still conveyed the elegance of old-world craftsmanship. Celia was fascinated with the shoe, both for the mystery of how it came to be there and the history of its owner. A high school art teacher, she added the shoe to her collection of objects to be sketched by her students, and then, 20 years later, passed the shoe on to the new owners of her home when she and her family moved. Another friend, Joe, has a reputation in his small town of Marshall for treasuring all things old. In fact, he and his wife, Carrie, have devoted a good share of their life to renovating a small hotel built there in 1873 as their family's home. A neighbor down the street who was rehabbing his own 100-year-old home told Joe, "You're going to like this," and pointed to a toolbox holding a well-worn girl's boot he had found between two wall studs. Since retirement from a clinical psychology practice, Joe has devoted himself to charitable pursuits, repairing and repurposing antique furniture for auctions and fundraisers. He saw a different possibility for the shoe, offering a $250 scholarship competition to Marshall High English students who wanted to try writing an essay, poem, or story about the shoe, now property of the Marshall Historical Society. Though 30 years separated my hearing the two shoe stories, it felt like too much of a coincidence, and a little light research revealed it wasn't. Placing a shoe in a wall, a floor, behind a chimney, or above a door during construction is a tradition that dates back to the 12th century. Largely a European practice, particularly in the UK, shoes were even placed beneath the choir stalls in England's Winchester Cathedral, circa 1304. Building historians guessed the concealed shoes originally served as magical charms to ward off witches, demons, and ghosts. Those shoes placed under a bedroom floor may have been associated with fertility. Think old woman who lived in a shoe. Which may also explain why shoes are traditionally tied to the bumpers of newlyweds' cars. In America, hiding a child's shoe in the wall was a strong tradition, mainly in the Northeast. But apparently the custom was carried all the way to the Midwest before evidently dying out in the mid-20th century. Superstition or quaint custom, I see concealing a shoe in a wall as a poignant symbol of faith, of the confidence, and of the risks that lie behind anyone's notion to build or renovate a home. A concealed child's shoe, scuffed, cracked, and worn, is like the penny tossed into a fountain, a talisman of hope.
Ron Davis is a retired English teacher and the author of Shiny Side Up, Musings on the Improbable Inclination to Travel on Two Wheels. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
From concealed shoes to your running shoes, it's the morning show, and we have a link to this weekend's turkey trot races right now up at wpr.org/mornings. And with a growing number, there's likely to be one near you wherever you are this morning. So let's stretch those hammies, lace up our running shoes, and burn some calories with a record-holding runner who's also helping beginners get started one stride at a time. What's it like to make it to the finish line? Especially if you may be dressed like a giant turkey for tomorrow's turkey trots. 1-800-642-1234. If you've had the experience, we'd be interested in having you share. You can always email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Tania Fisher, Director of Health and Wellness at Social X in Milwaukee, a young professional diversity and inclusion consulting group. Also lead captain of a local running group there called Fear. Also a five record holder at the UW-Milwaukee for her running and a member of the Athletic Hall of Fame. Tania, welcome back to the morning show.
Hi, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to have you. And let's start logistics, because I heard in the forecast this morning the temperature is going to be dropping, the wind's going to be going up. So for those who are trying to make it a little more than 3 miles running tomorrow, it's one thing to see the folks running in the summertime in the good weather. It's another thing to see them running in the wind and the cold. How do you prepare for your cold weather running, Tania?
So I always err on the caution of wearing more clothes than normal. So you can always take clothes off. You can never put clothes on that you don't have, right?
Right.
So, and I'm scary, and I always want to overdress because I hate being cold. So I would, for an outfit, if you're not wearing a giant turkey, because you'll definitely be warm, those get really sweaty, I can tell you that. So in any costume, I ran a full mascot before. It's hot in there.
Oh, man.
Yeah, if you're not doing that, I would suggest fleece-lined leggings and then a long-sleeve, dry-fit shirt to keep you from sweating, because afterwards you hate to be sweaty and cold. That's a horrible combination. And then maybe a short sleeve over it. And then maybe a thin zip up, little jacket. And then if you do have family members cheering you on, it's nice to always, if you can, take off those layers and kind of throw to them.
Oh, so you have people to give your clothes to as you get warmed up and get going.
Oh yeah, cheering is great. I love for you to cheer, but if you could take my clothes, yes, I'll love you forever.
It takes a team.
Yes, there you go. Yeah, and those jackets are nice because you can at least tie it around your waist if you do tend to get a little warm too.
But let's talk about that cold air, because that's the burning of the lungs is the thing I remember from running in the cold, Tania, is how that air hits your lungs and how that feels like it's on fire even though it's freezing.
Yeah. So, now we can be safe and prevent that by wearing a mask. those are really nice. They do have running masks. Before the pandemic, people were wearing those to run in the winter to cover up your cheeks, your face that gets so cold. Masks really do help with that. And you could be safe in the crowd.
Tania Fisher, our guest this morning, a record-holding runner in her own right, lead captain of a local running group in Milwaukee called FEAR, director of health and wellness at Social X in Milwaukee. If you've got questions about your first turkey trot or maybe some stories about your last turkey trot, 1-800-642-1234. So for those, Tania, who will be taking on a 5K for the first time tomorrow, how do they approach it mentally? And that's the other thing I remember about running is really is mind over matter. It really is one stride at a time, and it really is telling your body what to do, even though your body's arguing with you.
Yeah. So I always say that running is 90% mental and the rest is what you trained. Your mind is very powerful. So it's just keeping those positive affirmations and to have fun. That's the number one rule. You're out here to have fun. It's Thanksgiving Day. Majority of you will be running with family, and that's something to cherish and don't take for granted. So I would just say go out there and have fun. Don't start too fast. I think that is always a mistake by first time runners, that they start really fast. So I would just start really comfortably. And if you do start to feel like the race is moving too fast, it always settles. You'll always get into a pace where you feel comfortable after a half mile or mile.
And everyone, that's a mental thing too, right, Tania? I mean, you could feel like the pack's leaving you behind, but that's just the feeling. Hold your pace.
Right, right. Yes. Worry about yourself. Worry about your own race, what you're doing, not anyone else for sure. But that pack will, and I know your shoulders start to rise up to your neck. You know, your breathing starts to get heavy. It changes because you're worried that, you know, you're running too fast, you won't be able to last. Like, it will settle, I promise you. Those packs, they settle down. Everyone gets in their groove and smile and wave and laugh at the great costumes you're going to see out there and think about all that great food you're going to eat later.
There you go. Just get some exercise, make some room for the meal ahead of you. Tania Fisher, our guest, an avid runner in her own right. And Tania, I'm curious, what influenced you to start running? How did you get going?
So I started when I was 12. I'm Milwaukee born and raised. I went to Milwaukee School of Languages, and they had a race that was just, you had to run around the block, and I won, and I loved it. I love that feeling of winning, right? I got a little like trophy, and I liked that feeling. I liked that feeling of running. I liked that feeling of being competitive, and it was something that I knew I was good at. And being a girl, knowing something that you excel at is very important. So I like that. So, you know, I continued on to high school and college, and now I help other adults achieve that great feeling of running.
Well, it doesn't always feel that great when you're getting going. In fact, it can feel like a block might be too much to run for the first time. But if you can make it the block the first time, and you can make it a block and a step after the second time, isn't that how it works in the long run, Tania?
Yes. So with our running group, FEAR MKE, also stands for Forget Everything and Run, we are dedicated to helping those first time runners or runners of all levels. And yes, do not stress about, I have to run a mile. And if I don't run a mile, I'm not a runner. Just taking that one step at a time. I also coached high school track and cross country. So those kiddies, they're running for the first time as well.
Right.
So I just try to encourage them. Okay, let's look at this tree. Let's run to this tree. And when you get to this tree, you can walk. We'll walk to the next tree and then run to the next tree. And just continuing to do that. And then next time you can elongate it. You'll run to two trees ahead, maybe.
Tania Fisher, I really appreciate this perspective. And I'd be interested in knowing if anybody's planning on bringing their family to the Turkey Trots tomorrow at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest started running with her entire family, who runs a run around the block, which she won. And that was just the first finish line that she was first to meet. Tomorrow is not a race, though. It's just a run, and it's fun. So we'd like to hear from you before we're done with this hour. And our guest, Tania Fisher, at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So these turkey trot races are relatively new to me, but tomorrow will be Buffalo, New York's 126th annual turkey trot. They boldly claim to be the oldest consecutively run foot race in the world. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're running through Wisconsin winters and getting you ready for your turkey trot tomorrow. You plan to attend or run in a turkey trot this year? Where are you going? 1-800-642-1234 is the email to join our conversation. And our guest, Tania Fisher, a member of the UW-Milwaukee Athletic Hall of Fame with five running records to her name, and that's going all the way back to 2006. Let's go to Nancy in Green Bay this morning. Nancy, good morning. You're on with Tania Fisher.
Well, good morning.
Hi. Are you going to do a turkey trot tomorrow?
We are. Our whole family does this every year. We do the turkey trot here in Green Bay.
Tell us about the whole family. What do you mean there? You got how many generations are going to do the run?
Three and a dog. My husband and I, our son and his wife, and their two children and their dog, and they're coming from Minneapolis. We've done this for many, many years.
What is it about the turkey trot that keeps bringing your family back, Nancy?
Well, it's really a nice tradition to start off our Thanksgiving day. It's a good way to get some exercise before we eat all that food tomorrow. and it's just a really nice day. Very fun, not competitive, just a fun time.
And are there any costumes among your family that will be making their way down the parade or the race route tomorrow?
Well, there won't be from my husband and myself, but I never know what our children are going to do, so.
Can't wait. Have fun, and thank you for joining us this morning, Nancy.
Thank you.
Tania, the whole family running, it has me thinking about what I've seen outside my front door, and that is young mothers running with strollers, and I'm wondering, I'm wondering if you have any advice for young mothers with strollers and how they can continue to exercise and run with their baby in tow.
Yeah, so one of our FEAR captains, actually, Steve Broadway, he just had, he's our first FEAR captain baby. So we had to make sure that we bought him a running stroller. So we invested in a running stroller for him so he can make sure to have baby Brixton out there. And so I just would encourage either to start way in the front so you aren't in all that, you know, traffic with people, or in the back. If you're going to a turkey trot, to make sure you can maneuver. And then those crowds start to thin out and you'll have room to move around. But I'm going to plug my run group again. Really welcome to first time, you know, runners and mommies and daddies to come out with those babies. We love to see those kids, especially if you have a running stroller, if they just want to run, walk beside you. We are very encouraging of that. First, you know, these moms, you got enough to worry about. I don't want you to worry about, you know, like if you feel like you want to run and you can get out there, by all means, you know, go right ahead. It's hard for me to get out there and it's just me. So I hear you, I understand. But if you can get a run in and, you know, possibly get that baby on a nap during that run, go right ahead.
Tania, the other thing that we should mention for your run group, FEAR MKE, is that how many beautiful places there are to run in Milwaukee, how many sight lines there are, how getting along the lake on a beautiful day, there's just nothing like it out there.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. We run by the lake every Saturday morning, and it's just so nice to see so many other faces out there running or laying out, and it's great. So we love it.
Let's continue with your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Runners looking for long distance ideas, runners getting ready to get a turkey costume on and do a turkey trot tomorrow, about a 5K. Let us know about it. Josh in Oak Creek, you're on the morning show. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. So I did my first 5K in November, first one ever. As you prep for it, I noticed there was a debate about do you or don't you shower prior to going to your run? And it was like 50-50. People like, oh, no, don't do that. It'll mess you up. And then other people like, no, it wakes you up. You got to do it.
Not to shower? Josh, how was your first 5K, by the way? And will you be doing another one?
I definitely will be doing another one. No doubt about it. The last half mile was a bear.
Yeah.
But like she said, you got to run to that next tree. I mean, that's what you do.
Got to run to that next tree, one stride at a time. Really appreciate
that.
Yeah,
it was great.
Tania, what advice do you have for Josh? To shower or not to shower?
I would say to shower. I like to feel good before I start a race. I want to smell good. I want to look good. And yes, it does wake you up. So I have always showered before a race, even in college. I've always showered before.
Now, a lot of folks will be doing turkey trots tomorrow because they want to burn some calories before they load on some calories. But I'd be curious to know what sort of meal routine you'd have before a race or on race day, Tania.
So a lot of things happen during your race, especially this is the first time your body is doing things it's never done. I would not switch up your routine at all. So if you have a granola bar and coffee for breakfast, do that tomorrow. If you have a bagel, grapefruit, fruit, if that's what you do every day, I would not switch it up. I would do that. Also during your training, it might be too late, but whatever you had those mornings before your training, and if you didn't get an upset stomach or nothing weird happened, stick with that. I wouldn't switch to do anything different or new.
How much of running, and we talked about your 90% mental, but how much of running is also listening to your body, is just being aware of what your body is telling you about what it's going to do?
Oh, my goodness. That is everything. It's not worth it. So if you are, it's just not for a third shot tomorrow, not for any, you know, if you are feeling some aches and pains and you know your body, you know, if that's a level 3 and you know, like, oh, I can keep going. If you know that's hitting to level 8, 9, you know, you have to stop and, you know, check in with yourself and check in with your body to make sure you can finish or what you need to do. But that's very important. It's absolutely not worth it. There'll be other races too, other times.
You can always run. So if it's, if your body's telling you no, then it's probably best to listen. So as we get ready for tomorrow and, you know, through the winter, how do you keep yourself going? When you wake up in the morning, Tania, and you're saying, not your body so much, but your mind saying, you know what, I'm tired. I want to hit that snooze button about 8 times and then call it a day. What is it that keeps you on your feet and running?
So a lot of my fear members do. I initially was not planning on doing a turkey trot, but now some of those guys are, it's like, I don't know. I usually do run on my own, but, they're doing one tomorrow. So maybe I'll do one now because they're doing one and I want to hang out with them. So that's motivating, having friends that also enjoy that same crazy running activity that you do. I like to join a gym in the winter time. So yeah. Roof Fitness in Sherwood and Milwaukee. I like to do that in the winter as well. I host the 30 for 30 challenge, 30 minutes for 30 days starting January 2nd. Ooh. So that helps. Yeah. That helps me keeps me motivated, holds us all accountable. So those are some of the things. I love running, but sometimes, you know, I need to take a little breather from it and, get back to it and learn to appreciate it again.
And get to that finish line. Tania Fisher, appreciate it every time. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
Tania Fisher is Director of Health and Wellness at SocialX in Milwaukee, a young professional diversity and inclusion consulting group. She's a Hall of Famer at the UW-Milwaukee and lead captain of the local running group, Fear MKE. Just ahead, we talk with the author of a new book on the history of the Postal Service and the ongoing threats to its existence. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.